Welcome to Just Listen, a celebration of literature from Nashville Public Library. For more stories and poetry, visit our website at library.nashville.org. Please feel free to leave a comment or to make requests or recommendations. And now, for today's selection. Today's story, The Ledge, by Lawrence Sargent Hall, won first place in the 1960 O. Henry Prize Collection and has appeared in more than 30 anthologies. Based on actual events and initially rejected by Esquire and The New Yorker, the story was selected by editor John Updike as one of the best short stories of the 20th century. Hall's novel Stowaway received the 1962 William Faulkner Award for Best Debut Novel. Hall also contributed to several journals, including the Hudson Review. In 1941, Hall received his Ph.D. in English from Yale University. He taught at several educational institutions, including Deerfield Academy and Yale. From 1946 to 1986, he taught English at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. In 1956, he was a Carnegie visiting professor at Columbia University. From 1964, he was chairman of the Bowdoin Department of English. In 1986, he retired as Henry Leland Chapman Professor. He was an active advocate of the arts in Maine throughout his lifetime, and he died in 1993. Today's story, raw and cold and heartily masculine, follows the Christmas Day misadventures of a protagonist we know only as the Fisherman, whose promise of a day's shooting for his son and nephew is fulfilled in a brazen attempt to wrest from the hand of nature more than is enough, and, in fact, too much. And now, The Ledge, by Lawrence Sargent Hall. We begin. On Christmas morning before sunup, the fisherman embraced his warm wife and left his close bed. She did not want him to go. It was Christmas morning. He was a big, raw man with too much strength, whose delight in winter was to hunt the sea ducks that flew in to feed by the outer ledges, bare at low tide. As his bare feet touched the cold floor and the frosty air struck his nude flesh, he might have changed his mind in the dark of this special day. It was a home day, which made it seem natural to think of the outer ledges merely as some place he had shot ducks in the past. But he had promised his son, 13, and his nephew, 15, who came from inland. That was why he had given them his present of an automatic shotgun each the night before, on Christmas Eve. Rough man though he was known to be, and no spoiler of boys, he kept his promises when he understood what they meant. And to the boys, as to him, home meant where you came for rest after you had had your Christmas fill of action and excitement. His legs astride, his arms raised, the fisherman stretched as high as he could in the dim privacy of his bedroom. Above the snug murmur of his wife's protest, he heard the wind in the pines and knew it was easterly, as the boys had hoped, and he had surmised the night before. Conditions would be ideal, and when they were, anybody ought to take advantage of them. The birds would be flying. The boys would get a man's sport their first time outside on the ledges. His son at 13, small but steady and experienced, was fierce to grow up in hunting, to graduate from sheltered waters and the blinds along the shores of the inner bay. His nephew at 15, an overgrown farm boy, had a farm boy's love of the sea, though he could not swim a stroke and was often sick in choppy weather. That was the reason his father, the fisherman's brother, was a farmer and chose to sleep in on the holiday morning at his brother's house. Many of the ones the fisherman had grown up with were regularly seasick and could not swim, but they were unafraid of the water. They could not have dreamed of being anything but fishermen. The fisherman himself could swim like a seal and was never sick, and he would sooner die than be anything else. He dressed in the cold and dark and woke the boys gruffly. They tumbled out of bed, their instincts instantly awake while their thoughts still fumbled slumbrously. The fisherman's wife in the adjacent bedroom heard them apparently trying to find their clothes, mumbling sleepily and happily to each other, while her husband went down to the hot kitchen to fry eggs sunny side up, she knew, because that was how they all liked them. Always in winter, she hated to have them go outside. The weather was so treacherous, and there were so few others out in case of trouble. To the fishermen, these were no more than woman's fears, to be taken for granted and laughed off. When they were first married, they fought miserably every fall, because she was after him constantly to put his boat up until spring. The fishing was all outside in winter, and though prices were high, the storms made the rate of attrition high on gear. Nevertheless, he did well, so she could do nothing with him. People thought him a hard man, and gave him the reputation of being all out for himself because he was inclined to brag and be disdainful. If it was true, and his own brother was one of those who strongly felt it was, they lived better than others, and his brother had small right to criticize. There had been times when, in her loneliness, she had yearned to leave him for another man, but it would have been dangerous. So over the years she had learned to shut her mind to his hard driving and take what comfort she might from his unsympathetic competence. Only once or twice, perhaps, had she gone so far as to dwell guiltily on what it would be like to be a widow. The thought that her boy, possibly because he was small, would not be insensitive like his father, and the rattle of dishes and smell of frying bacon downstairs in the kitchen shut off from the rest of the chilly house, restored the cozy feeling that she had had before she was alone in bed. She heard them after a while go out and shut the back door. Under her windows she heard the snow grind dryly beneath their boots and her husband's sharp, exasperated commands to the boys. She shivered slightly in the envelope of her own warmth. She listened to the noise of her son and nephew talking elatedly. Twice she caught the glimmer of their lights on the white ceiling above the window as they went down the path to the shore. There would be frost on the skiff and freezing suds at the water's edge. She herself used to go gunning when she was younger. Now, it seemed to her, anyone going out like that on a Christmas morning had to be incurably male. They would none of them think about her until they returned and piled the birds they had shot on top of the sink for her to dress. Ripping into the quiet pre-dawn cold, she heard the hot snarl of the outboard taking them out to the boat. It died as abruptly as it had burst into life. 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes later, the big engine broke into a warm, reassuring roar. He had the best of equipment, and he kept it in the best of condition. She closed her eyes. It would not be too long before the others would be up for Christmas. The summer drone of the exhaust deepened. Then gradually it faded in the wind until it was lost at sea, or she slept. The engine had started immediately in spite of the temperature. This put the fisherman in a good mood. He was proud of his boat. Together he and the two boys heaved the skiff and outboard into the stern and secured it athwartships. His son went forward along the deck, iridescent in the ray of the light the nephew shone through the windshield, and cast the mooring pennant loose into the darkness. The fisherman swung to starboard, glanced at his compass, and headed seaward down the obscure bay. There would be just enough visibility by the time they reached the headland to navigate the crooked channel between the islands. It was the only nasty stretch of water. The fisherman had done it often in fog or at night. He always swore he could go anywhere in the bay blindfolded. But there was no sense in taking chances if you didn't have to. From the mouth of the channel, he could lay a straight course for Brown Cow Island, anchor the boat out of sight behind it, and from the skiff, set their decoys off Devil's Hump 300 yards to seaward. By then the tide would be clearing the ledge and they would land and be ready to shoot around half tide. It was early, it was Christmas, and it was farther out than most hunters cared to go in this season of the closing year, so that he felt sure no one would be taking possession ahead of them. He had shot thousands of ducks there in his day. The Hump was by far the best hunting. Only thing was, you had to plan for the right conditions because you didn't have too much time. About 4 hours was all, and you had to get it before 3 in the afternoon when the birds left and went out to sea ahead of nightfall. They had it figured exactly right for today. The ledge would not be going under until after the gunning was over, and they would be home for supper in good season. With a little luck, the boys would have a skiff load of birds to show for their first time outside. Well beyond the legal limit, which was no matter. You took what you could get in this life, or the next man made out and you didn't. The fisherman had never failed to make out Gunning from Devil's Hump, and this trip, he had a hunch, would be above ordinary. The easterly wind would come up just stiff enough, the tide was right, and it was going to storm by tomorrow morning, so the birds would be moving. Things were perfect. The old fierceness was in his bones. Keeping a weather eye to the murk out front and a hand on the wheel, he reached over and cuffed both boys playfully as they stood together close to the head of the exhaust pipe running up through the center of the house. They poked back at him and shouted above the drumming engine, making bets as they always did on who would shoot the most birds. This trip they had the thrill of new guns, the best money could buy, and a man's hunting ground. The black retriever wagged at them and barked. He was too old and arthritic to be allowed in December water, but he was jaunty anyway at being brought along. Groping in his pocket for his pipe, the fisherman suddenly had his high spirits rocked by the discovery that he had left his tobacco at home. He swore. Anticipation of a day out with nothing to smoke made him incredulous. He searched his clothes and then he searched them again, unable to believe the tobacco was not somewhere. When the boys inquired what was wrong, he spoke angrily to them, blaming them for being in some devious way at fault. They were instantly crestfallen and willing to put back after the tobacco, though they could appreciate what it meant only through his irritation. But he bitterly refused. That would throw everything out of phase. He was a man who did things the way he set out to do. He clamped his pipe between his teeth, and twice more during the next few minutes he ransacked his clothes in disbelief. He was no stoic. For one relaxed moment he considered putting about and gunning somewhere nearer home. Instead he held his course and sucked the empty pipe, consoling himself with the reflection that at least he had whiskey enough if it got too uncomfortable on the ledge. Peremptorily he made the boys check to make certain the bottle was really in the knapsack with the lunches where he thought he had taken care to put it. When they reassured him, he despised his fate a little less. The fisherman's judgment was, as usual, accurate. By the time they were abreast of the headland, there was sufficient light so that he could wind his way among the reefs without slackening speed. At last he turned his bows toward open ocean, and as the winter dawn filtered upward through long layers of smoky cloud on the eastern rim, his spirits rose again with it. He opened the throttle, steadied on his course, and settled down to the two-hour run. The wind was stronger but seemed less cold coming from the sea. The boys had withdrawn from the fishermen and were talking together while they watched the sky through the windows. The boat churned solidly through a light chop, flinging spray off her flaring bows. Astern, the headland thinned rapidly till it lay like a blackened sill on the gray water. No other boats were abroad. The boys fondled their new guns, sighted along the barrels, worked the mechanisms, compared notes, boasted, and gave each other contradictory advice. The fishermen got their attention once and pointed at the horizon. They peered through the windows and saw what looked like a black scum floating on top of gently agitated water. It wheeled and tilted, rippled, curled, then rose, strung itself out, and became a huge raft of ducks escaping over the sea. A good sign. The boys rushed out and leaned over the washboards in the wind and spray to see the flock curl below the horizon. Then they went and hovered around the hot engine, bewailing their lot. If only they had been already set out and waiting. Maybe these ducks would be crazy enough to return later and be slaughtered. Ducks were known to be foolish. In due course and right on schedule, they anchored at mid-morning in the lee of Brown Cow Island. They put the skiff overboard and loaded it with guns, knapsacks, and decoys. The boys showed their eagerness by being clumsy. The fisherman showed his in bad temper and abuse, while they silently accepted in the absorbed tolerance of being boys. No doubt they laid it to lack of tobacco. By outboard, they rounded the island and pointed due east in the direction of a ridge of foam which could be seen whitening the surface 300 yards away. They set the decoys in a broad, straddling V, opening wide into the ocean. The fisherman warned them not to get their hands wet, and when they did, he made them carry on with red and painful fingers in order to teach them. Once the last decoy was bobbing among his fellows, brisk and alluring, they got their numbed fingers inside their oilskins and hugged their warm crotches. In the meantime, the fishermen had turned the skiff toward the patch of foam, where, as if by magic, like a black glossy rib of earth, the ledge had broken through the belly of the sea. Carefully, they inhabited the slippery nub of the North American continent, while the unresting Atlantic swelled and swirled as it had for eons around the indomitable edges. They hauled the skiff after them, established themselves as comfortably as they could in a shallow sump on top, lay on their sides a foot or so above the water, and waited, guns in hand. In time, the fishermen took a thermos bottle from the knapsack, and they drank steaming coffee and waited for the nodding decoys to lure in the first flight to the rock. Eventually, the boys got hungry and restless. The fishermen let them open the picnic lunch and eat one sandwich apiece, which they both shared with the dog. Having no tobacco, the fisherman himself would not eat. Actually, the day was relatively mild, and they were warm enough at present in their woolen clothes and socks underneath oilskins and hip boots. After a while, however, the boys began to feel cramped. Their nerves were agonized by inactivity. The nephew complained and was severely told by the fisherman, who pointed to the dog, crouched unmoving except for his white-rimmed eyes, that part of doing a man's hunting was learning how to wait. But he was beginning to have misgivings of his own. This could be one of those days where all the right conditions masked an incalculable flaw. If the fisherman had been alone, as he often was, stopping off when the necessary coincidence of tide and time occurred on his way home from hauling trawls, and had plenty of tobacco, he would not have fidgeted. The boys being nervous made him nervous. He growled at them again. When it came, it was likely to come all at once, and then in a few moments be over. He warned them not to slack off, never to slack off, to be always ready. Under his rebuke, they kept their tortured peace, though they could not help shifting and twisting until he lost what patience he had left and bullied them into lying still. A duck could see an eyelid twitch. If the dog could go without moving, so could they. "Here it comes," the fisherman said tersely at last. The boys quivered with quick relief. The flock came in downward, quartering slightly, myriad, black and swift. "Beautiful," breathed the fisherman's son. "All right," said the fisherman, intense and precise. "Aim at singles in the thickest part of the flock. Wait for me to fire, and then don't stop shooting till your gun's empty." He rolled up onto his left elbow and spread his legs to brace himself. The flock bore down, arrowy and vibrant. Then 100 yards beyond the decoys, it veered off. "They're going away," the boys cried, sighting in. "Not yet," snapped the fisherman. "They're coming round." The flock changed shape, folded over itself, and drove into the wind in a tight arc. "Thousands," the boys hissed through their teeth. All at once, a whistling storm of black and white broke over the decoys. "Now," the fisherman shouted. "Perfect." And he opened fire at the flock just as it hung suspended in momentary chaos above the decoys. The three pulled at their triggers and the birds splashed into the water until the last report went off unheard, the last smoking shell flew unheeded over their shoulders, and the last of the routed flock scattered, diminishing, diminishing, diminishing in every direction. Exultantly, the boys dropped their guns, jumped up, and scrambled for the skiff. "I'll handle that skiff," the fisherman shouted at them. They stopped. Gripping the painter and balancing himself, he eased the skiff into the water stern first and held the bow hard against the side of the rock shelf the skiff had rested on. "You stay here," he said to the nephew. "No sense in all three of us going in the boat." The boy on the reef gazed at the gray water rising and falling hypnotically along the glistening edge. It had dropped about a foot since their arrival. "I want to go with you," he said in a sullen tone, his eyes on the streaming eddies. "You want to do what I tell you if you want a gun with me," answered the fisherman harshly. The boy couldn't swim, and he wasn't going to have him climbing in and out of the skiff any more than necessary. Besides, he was too big. The fisherman took his son in the skiff and cruised round and round among the decoys, picking up dead birds. Meanwhile, the other boy stared unmoving after them from the highest part of the ledge. Before they had quite finished gathering the dead birds, the fisherman cut the outboard and dropped to his knees in the skiff. "Down!" he yelled. "Get down!" About a dozen birds came tolling in. "Shoot! Shoot!" his son hollered from the bottom of the boat to the boy on the ledge. The dog, who had been running back and forth whining, sank to his belly, his muzzle on his forepaws. But the boy on the ledge never stirred. The ducks took late alarm at the skiff, swerved aside and into the air, passing with a whir no more than 50 feet over the head of the boy, who remained on the ledge like a statue, without his gun, watching the two crouching in the boat. The fisherman's son climbed onto the ledge and held the painter. The bottom of the skiff was covered with feathery black and white bodies, with feet upturned and necks lolling. He was jubilant. "We got 27, he told his cousin. "How's that? 9 apiece. Boy," he added, "what a cool Christmas." The fisherman pulled the skiff onto its shelf, and all three went and lay down again in anticipation of the next flight. The son, reloading, patted his shotgun affectionately. "I'm going to get me 10 next time," he said. Then he asked his cousin, "What's the matter? Didn't you see the strays?" "Yeah," the boy said. "How come you didn't shoot at them?" "Didn't feel like it," replied the boy, still with a trace of sullenness. "You stupid or something?" The fisherman's son was astounded. "What a Highlander!" But the fisherman, though he said nothing, knew that the older boy had had an attack of ledge fever. "Cripes!" his son kept at it. "I'd at least have tried." "Shut up," the fisherman finally told him, "and leave him be." At slack water, 3 more flocks came in, one right after the other, and when it was over, the skiff was half full of clean, dead birds. During the subsequent lull, they broke out the lunch and ate it all and finished the hot coffee. For a while, the fisherman sucked away on his cold pipe. Then he had himself a swig of whiskey. The boys passed the time contentedly jabbering about who shot the most. There were 92 all told. Which of their friends they would show the biggest ones to, how many each could eat at a meal, provided they didn't have to eat any vegetables. Now and then they heard sporadic, distant gunfire on the mainland, at its nearest point about 2 miles to the north. Once far off, they saw a fishing boat making in the direction of home. At length, the fisherman got a hand inside his oilskins and produced his watch. "Do we have to go now?" asked his son. "Not just yet," he replied. "Pretty soon." Everything had been perfect, as good as he had ever had it. Because he was getting tired of the boy's chatter, he stood up, heavily in his hip boots, and stretched. The tide had turned and was coming in, the sky was more ashen, and the wind had freshened enough so that whitecaps were beginning to blossom. It would be a good hour before they had to leave the ledge and pick up the decoys. However, he guessed they would leave a little early. On account of the rising wind, he doubted there would be much more shooting. He stepped carefully along the back of the ledge to work his kinks out. It was also getting a little colder. The whiskey had begun to warm him, but he was unprepared for the sudden blaze that flashed upward inside him from belly to head. He was standing looking at the shelf where the skiff was. Only the foolish skiff was not there. For the second time that day, the fisherman felt the deep vacuity of disbelief. He gaped, seeing nothing but the flat shelf of rock. He whirled, started toward the boys, slipped, recovered himself, fetched a complete circle, and stared at the unimaginably empty shelf. Its emptiness made him feel as if everything he had done that day so far, his life so far, he had dreamed. What could have happened? The tide was still nearly a foot below. There had been no sea to speak of. The skiff could hardly have slid off by itself. For the life of him, consciously careful as he inveterately was, he could not now remember hauling it up the last time. Perhaps in the heat of hunting he had left it to the boy. Perhaps he could not remember which was the last time. "Christ!" he exclaimed loudly, without realizing it because he was so entranced by the invisible event. "What's wrong, Dad?" asked his son, getting to his feet. The fisherman went blind with uncontainable rage. "Get back down there where you belong!" he screamed. He scarcely noticed the boy sink back in amazement. In a frenzy, he ran along the ledge, thinking the skiff might have drawn up at another place, though he knew better. There was no other place. He stumbled, half-falling, back to the boys who were gawking at him in consternation, as though he had gone insane. "God damn it!" he yelled savagely, grabbing both of them and yanking them to their knees. "Get on your feet!" "What's wrong?" his son repeated in a stifled voice. "Never mind what's wrong," he snarled. "Look for the skiff. It's adrift." When they peered around, he gripped their shoulders, brutally facing them about. "Downwind!" He slammed his fist against his thigh. "Jesus!" he cried, struck to madness at their stupidity. At last he sighted the skiff himself, magically bobbing along the grim sea like a decoy, a quarter of a mile to leeward on a direct course for home. The impulse to strip himself naked was succeeded instantly by a queer calm. He simply sat down on the ledge and forgot everything except the marvelous mystery. As his awareness partially returned, he glanced toward the boys. They were still observing the skiff speechlessly. Then he was gazing into the clear young eyes of his son. "Dad?" asked the boy steadily. "What do we do now?" That brought the fisherman upright. "The first thing we have to do," he heard himself saying with infinite tenderness as if he were making love, "is think." "Could you swim it?" asked the son. He shook his head and smiled at them. They smiled quickly back, too quickly. 100 yards, maybe, in this water. I wish I could," he added. It was the most intimate and pitiful thing he had ever said. He walked in circles around them, trying to break the stall his mind was left in. He gauged the level of the water. To the eye, it was quite stationary, 6 inches from the shelf at this second. The fisherman did not have to mark it on the side of the rock against the passing of time to prove to his reason that it was rising, always rising. Already it was over the brink of reason, beyond the margins of thought, a senseless measurement, no sense to it. All his life, the fisherman had tried to lick the element of time by getting up earlier and going to bed later, owning a faster boat, planning more than the day would hold, and tackling just one other job before the deadline fell. If, as on rare occasions he had the grand illusion, he ever really had beaten the game, he would need to call on all his reserves of practice and cunning now. He sized up the scant but unforgivable 300 yards to Brown Cow Island. Another 100 yards behind it, his boat rode at anchor, where, had he been aboard, he could have cut in a fathometer to plumb the profound and occult seas, or a ship-to-shore radio on which, in an interminably short time, he would have heard his wife's voice talking to him over the air about homecoming. "Couldn't we wave something so somebody would see us?" his nephew suggested. The fisherman spun around. "Load your guns," he ordered. They loaded as if the air had suddenly gone frantic with birds. "I'll fire once and count to five. Then you fire. Count to five. That way they won't just think it's only somebody gunning ducks. We'll keep doing that." "We've only got just 2.5 boxes left," said his son. The fisherman nodded, understanding that from beginning to end their situation was purely mathematical, like the ticking of the alarm clock in his silent bedroom. Then he fired. The dog, who had been keeping watch over the decoys, leaped forward and yelped in confusion. They all counted off, fired the first 5 rounds by threes, and reloaded. The fisherman scanned first the horizon, then the contracting borders of the ledge, which was the sole place the water appeared to be climbing. Soon it would be over the shelf. They counted off and fired the second 5 rounds. "We'll hold off a while on the last one," the fisherman told the boys. He sat down and pondered what a trivial thing was a skiff. This one he and the boy had knocked together in a day was a gun, manufactured for killing. His son tallied up the remaining shells, grouping them symmetrically in threes on the rock when the wet box fell apart. "Too short," he announced. They reloaded and laid the guns on their knees. Behind thickening clouds, they could not see the sun going down. The water coming up was growing blacker. The fisherman thought he might have told his wife they would be home before dark since it was Christmas Day. He realized he had forgotten about it being any particular day. The tide would not be high until 2 hours after sunset. When they did not get in by nightfall and could not be raised by radio, she might send somebody to hunt for them right away. He rejected this arithmetic immediately, with a sickening shock, recollecting it was a 2.5 hour run at best. Then it occurred to him that she might send somebody on the mainland who was nearer. She would think he had engine trouble. He rose and searched the shoreline, barely visible. Then his glance dropped to the toy shoreline at the edges of the reef. The shrinking ledge, so sinister from a boat, grew dearer minute by minute, as though the whole world he gazed on from horizon to horizon balanced on its contracting rim. He checked the water level and found the shelf awash. Some of what went through his mind the fishermen told to the boys. They accepted it without comment. If he caught their eyes, they looked away to spare him, or because they were not yet old enough to face what they saw. Mostly they watched the rising water. The fisherman was unable to initiate a word of encouragement. He wanted one of them to ask him whether somebody would reach them ahead of the tide. He would have found it possible to say yes, but they did not inquire. The fisherman was not sure how much, at their age, they were able to imagine. Both of them had seen from the docks drowned bodies put ashore out of boats. Sometimes they grasped things, and sometimes not. He supposed they might be longing for the comfort of their mothers, and was astonished, as much as he was capable of any astonishment except the supreme one, to discover himself wishing he had not left his wife's dark, close, naked bed that morning. "Is it time to shoot now?" asked his nephew. "Pretty soon," he said, as if he were putting off making good on a promise. "Not yet." His own boy cried softly for a brief moment. Like a man, his face averted in an effort neither to give nor show pain. "Before school starts," the fisherman said, wonderfully detached, "we'll go to town and I'll buy you boys anything you want." With great difficulty, in a dull tone as though he did not in the least desire it, his son said after a pause, "I'd like one of those new 30-horse outboards." "All right," said the fisherman, and to his nephew, "How about you?" The nephew shook his head desolately. "I don't want anything," he said. After another pause, the fisherman's son said, "Yes, he does, Dad. He wants one, too." "All right," the fisherman said again, and said no more. The dog whined in uncertainty and licked the boys' faces where they sat together. Each threw an arm over his back and hugged him. Three strays flew in and sat companionably down among the stiff-necked decoys. The dog crouched, obedient to his training. The boys observed them listlessly. Presently, sensing something untoward, the ducks took off, splashing the wave tops with feet and wingtips into the dusky waste. The sea began to make up in the mounting wind, and the wind bore a new and deathly chill. The fishermen, scouring the somber, dwindling shadow of the mainland for a sign, hoped it would not snow. But it did. First a few flakes, then a flurry, then storming past horizontally. The fisherman took one long, bewildered look at Brown Cow Island, 300 yards dead to leeward, and got to his feet. Then it shut in, as if what was happening on the ledge was too private even for the last wan light of the expiring day. "Last round," the fisherman said austerely. The boys rose and shouldered their tacit guns. The fisherman fired into the flying snow. He counted methodically to 5. His son fired and counted. His nephew. All 3 fired and counted. 4 rounds. "You've got 1 left, Dad," his son said. The fisherman hesitated another second. Then he fired the final shell. Its pathetic report, like the spat of a pop gun, whipped away on the wind and was instantly blanketed in falling snow. Night fell all in a moment to meet the ascending sea. They were now barely able to make one another out through driving snowflakes, dim as ghosts in their yellow oilskins. The fisherman heard a sea break and glanced down where his feet were. They seemed to be wound in a snowy sheet. Gently he took the boys by the shoulders and pushed them in front of him, feeling with his feet along the shallow sump to the place where it triangulated into a sharp crevice at the highest point of the ledge. "Face ahead," he told them. "Put the guns down."
"I'd like to hold mine, Dad," begged his son.
"Put it down," said the fisherman. "The tide won't hurt it. Now brace your feet against both sides and stay there." They felt the dog, who was pitch black, running up and down in perplexity between their straddled legs.
"Dad," said his son, "what about the pooch?"
If he had called the dog by name, it would have been too personal. The fisherman would have wept. As it was, he had all he could do to keep from laughing. He bent his knees, and when he touched the dog, hoisted him under one arm. The dog's belly was soaking wet. So they waited, marooned in their consciousness, surrounded by a monstrous tidal space which was slowly, slowly closing them out. In this space, the periwinkle between the fisherman's boots was king. While hovering airborne in his mind, he had an inward glimpse of his house as curiously separate, like a June mirage. Snow, rocks, seas, wind, the fisherman had lived by all his life. Now he thought he had never comprehended what they were, and he hated them. Though they had not changed, he was deadly chilled. He set out to ask the boys if they were cold. There was no sense. He thought of the whiskey and sidled backward, still holding the awkward dog, till he located the bottle underwater with his toe. He picked it up squeamishly as though afraid of getting his sleeve wet, worked his way forward and bent over his son. "Drink it," he said, holding the bottle against the boy's ribs. The boy tipped his head back, drank, coughed hotly, then vomited.
"I can't," he told his father wretchedly. "Try, try," the fisherman pleaded, as if it meant the difference between life and death.
The boy obediently drank, and again he vomited hotly. He shook his head against his father's chest and passed the bottle forward to his cousin, who drank and vomited also. Passing the bottle back, the boys dropped it in the frigid water between them. When the waves reached his knees, the fisherman set the warm dog loose and said to his son, "Turn around and get up on my shoulders." The boy obeyed. The fisherman opened his oilskin jacket and twisted his hands behind him through his suspenders, clamping the boy's booted ankles with his elbows.
"What about the dog?"
the boy asked. "He'll make his own way all right," the fisherman said. "He can take the cold water." His knees were trembling. Every instinct shrieked for gymnastics. He ground his teeth and braced like a colossus against the sides of the submerged crevice. The dog, having lived faithfully as though one of them for 11 years, swam a few minutes in and out around the fisherman's legs, not knowing what was happening, and left them without a whimper. He would swim and swim at random by himself, round and round in the blinding night, and when he had swum routinely through the paralyzing water all he could, he would simply, in one incomprehensible moment, drown. Almost the fisherman, waiting out infinity, envied him his pattern. Freezing seas swept by, flooding inexorably up and down as the earth sank away imperceptibly beneath them. The boy called out once to his cousin. There was no answer. The fisherman, marveling on a terror without voice, was dumbly glad when the boy did not call again. His own boots were long full of water. With no sensation left in his straddling legs, he dared not move them. So long as the seas came sideways against his hips and then sideways against his shoulders, he might balance no telling how long. The upper half of him was what felt frozen. His legs, disengaged from his nerves and his will, he came to regard quite scientifically. They were the absurd, precarious access around which reeled and surged universal tumult. The waves would come on and on. He could not visualize how many tossing reinforcements lurked in the night beyond, inexhaustible numbers, and he wept in supernatural fury at each because it was higher, till he transcended hate and took them, swaying like a convert, one by one as they lunged against him, and away aimlessly into their own undisputed wild realm. From his hips upward, the fisherman stretched to his utmost as a man does whose spirit reaches out of dead sleep.
The boy's head, none too high, must be at least 7 feet above the ledge. Though growing larger every minute, it was a small, light life. The fisherman meant to hold it there, if need be, through 1,000 tides. By and by, the boy, slumped on the head of his father, asked, "Is it over your boots, Dad?" "Not yet," the fisherman said. Then through his teeth he added, "If I fall, kick your boots off, swim for it, downwind, to the island."
"You?"
the boy finally asked. The fisherman nodded against the boy's belly. "Won't see each other," he said. The boy did for the fisherman the greatest thing that can be done. He may have been too young for perfect terror, but he was old enough to know there were things beyond the power of any man. All he could do, he did, by trusting his father to do all he could, and asking nothing more. The fisherman, rocked to his soul by a sea, held his eyes shut upon the interminable night. "Is it time now?" the boy said. The fisherman could hardly speak. "Not yet," he said. "Not just yet."
As the landmass pivoted toward sunlight the day after Christmas, a tiny fleet of small craft converged offshore like iron filings to a magnet. At daybreak, they found the skiff floating unscathed off the headland, half full of ducks and snow. The shooting had been good, as someone hearing on the nearby mainland the previous afternoon had supposed. 2 hours afterward, they found the unharmed boat adrift 5 miles at sea. At high noon, they found the fisherman at ebb tide, his right foot jammed cruelly into a glacial crevice of the ledge beside 3 shotguns, his hands tangled behind him in his suspenders, and under his right elbow, a rubber boot with a sock and a live starfish in it. After dragging unlit depths all day for the boys, they towed the fisherman home in his own boat at sundown, and in the frost of evening, mute with discovering purgatory, laid him on his wharf for his wife to see. She, somehow, standing on the dock as in her frequent dream, gazing at the fisherman pure as crystal on the icy boards, a small rubber boot still frozen under one clenched arm, saw him exaggerated beyond remorse or grief, absolved of his mortality.
Thanks for joining us. Tune in to another session of Just Listen by visiting your Nashville Public Library website at library.nashville.org.